Like, did you rename it?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Upon This Rock. My name is Max, and I'm here with the one, the only, the infamous, the stupendous, the pod mother, my wife, Stephanie. Hi, Steph. How are you?
Good. Hi, everybody.
Good to have you back.
It's good to be back. It's good to have you back.
No, thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. After a year of bugging me, I finally came back.
I know.
Okay, so here's what we want to do today. I am a big sports guy. I will watch anything sports. You know that. I will listen to just about anything sports. You know that. In sports kind of media world, we have this thing called a hot take. A hot take is something that you believe to be true mostly, but it's a little bit outlandish. It's a little bit in your face. It might upset some people because you don't actually believe it all the way. I mean, maybe you do. Then it's really spicy. Then it's like a spicy hot take. And we want all the spice here, by the way. But a hot take, generally something you believe to be mostly true, but that you say, you know, to be purposefully kind of out there and all that kind of stuff. So what I want to do is hot take theology. I asked you to come up with two spicy hot takes that you have related to God, spirituality, the Bible, whatever. I don't know them. You have not told me these two takes. They are just in your noggin. Yep. I have two. I have not told them to you. And we're going to go back and forth, each giving our hot take. And I have my phone here. And we're going to do, actually, I turned my phone off. So let's do it on the watch. We're going to do 8 minutes for each take. You're going to give a take. I'll give a take, whatever order we go in. 8 minutes. We'll talk about it. You defend the spice of your hot take. The other person can kind of poke holes in it. And then we'll go to another one. Do you have your hot takes ready?
Yes.
Are you ready for all the blowback that you're going to get from your hot takes?
No.
Are you ready for all of the internet memes? Not really. That will come of your hot takes.
Thankfully, they're not happening.
Are they on a spicy scale? Are they like a green pepper, a jalapeno, habanero, the ghost chili? How spicy?
I actually don't know. I'm curious.
Oh, I love this.
And then you will give me your response.
I love this. Okay. 8 minutes on the clock.
Okay.
I am the host, and therefore I decide
when the 8 minutes are or what?
I also decide when the 8 minutes are up. They're actually an arbitrary 8 minutes.
Okay.
But I decide who goes first because I am the host. And therefore you go first.
All right.
Give me your number one spicy hot take. Go.
Okay. My first hot take is that I believe getting a vasectomy or getting your tubes tied is playing God.
Shots fired.
I wish everyone could see your face right now.
I'm so glad this is not a video going to go up on YouTube. Okay. All right. Explain yourself. I'm literally at a loss for words.
This is great. So what is it for the pepper scale?
Well, because full disclosure, we are in this conversation right now in family planning and all this kind of stuff. So we're doing live family planning counseling on the podcast.
It's so true. I think that it's playing God because God gave us our cycles, women a cycle, and a very clear rhythm of when we could potentially get pregnant. And there are ways to prevent that obviously aren't 100% because God created her bodies incredibly good at reproduction. That was in his design. And I feel like getting a vasectomy or getting your tubes tied is saying like there's some flaw in God's creation or design of because he naturally has a time in a woman's life that they are able or they aren't able to anymore reproduce. So like you are speeding up that time and saying, in my mind, you're kind of saying to God, like, I have this figured out more than you do. It's no longer a good idea for me to have kids, even though in every single passage in scripture that children are talked about, they're talked about as a gift and a blessing and only good things. And the narrative of our culture is the opposite. But I feel like by us doing something so invasive and clearly like only at the hands of science and the things in the medical field, it hasn't even been available to people for that long as well. But yeah, that we're playing God and saying, hey, your natural design for womanhood and family is actually flawed, and we better know when we should stop our family than you do, and we don't want your good gifts that you're giving us.
Okay, so real quick, is the only right response then natural family planning?
As in, like, cycles? Or do you mean, like...
I mean, no contraceptives, like, no... yeah, obviously we're talking about vasectomies, tube sizes, all that kind of stuff, but so no contraceptives of any kind, because functionally they're all doing the same thing. They are preventing a natural occurrence from happening. Now we could go down the rabbit trail of how those certain ones do it, mm-hmm. but that's what they're all doing. And so is the only, in your view, the only ethical, moral way to do it is natural family planning, where you are basically having sex around the woman's cycle so she does not get pregnant?
No, I think there's a little more nuance there. But two lines being, one, something so permanent. Like, there is no, really, I mean, yes, the statistics are just alarmingly small. There is no, like, quotes, act of God of getting pregnant with a vasectomy or a tubes type. Like, you are saying, I am done. This is a permanent decision. I'm not doing it. And then you have all of the contraceptions like that are, do things with your hormones. And I think those are also hot take, sinful. And yes, I went there, sinful, because they have abortive mechanisms. And even if they work at that level, very, 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 very rarely, they still have that mechanism of action. So I think those should not even be on the table. Even more so, I think, than vasectomy and tubes tied, because they're, you're not killing a baby, you're stopping it, right? You're preventing it. That's what the issue is right now that we're discussing. But contraception, like any hormonal things, yeah, they actually can and do kill baby, so because they're abortive. So I think those are completely off the table. So that leaves family planning, but also other options like condoms, diaphragms, spermicide, and then your natural family planning cycle. So I think all of those four that I just mentioned, those are all on the table as options that I feel like could be used.
So then what's the difference between, is it just the permanency that is the difference between a vasectomy and a condom? Because functionally, again, they're doing the same thing. They're preventing something from happening. And it's not abortive, it's a preventative, right? You're putting a goalie in the net. One is just, you're basically taking the net off the ice. Right. And the other one is not. Is that the only?
Yeah, so I see it more as like this beautiful dance with God. That's how I would describe it. Like, I think I am done. And when I pray about it, I feel like I am done. So therefore, I'm going to use this thing, such as a condom, that to the best of my understanding of my cycle, and hope to prevent this baby, but also still allow God to be God. And there can be these crazy times where you ovulate and you can get pregnant later or before. And that leaves that dance or that like openness of like, I think I know what you're saying, but I also want to leave space here for not like an act of Mary getting pregnant, like this divine act of God. But like, hey, I think I know. I'm going to act out with these things like a condom or natural family planning. But ultimately, I trust that like if I'm meant to be pregnant, I will be pregnant.
So what are there any exceptions to this? I'm thinking like, so you've had two hard pregnancies. We've had four kids, two of which you've ended up in the hospital, almost died. One of our conversations around stopping having kids after four was around if you get pregnant, we are just rolling the dice again. Again, we're just doing family counseling here on the podcast. But we're not the only ones who go through something like this, right? Where it isn't just about the baby. It's about you and your health. And there are all kinds of complications. You're a midwife, so you know far more about them than I do. But where getting pregnant actually is a danger both to you. And so the vasectomy or getting your tubes tied is a way to actually, you're not trying to just prevent having a baby. You're trying to prevent a medical emergency that could be life-threatening or very serious. How does that play into it? And then our timer's probably closed up.
Yeah, I think that should play into the conversation. And I don't know if I have all the language of how it should play into the conversation. But I do think the normal, healthy couple maybe would have this dialogue differently than the ones that are struggling with actual real life ramifications. Because I do think there's a point to like stewarding what we do have. And like if it's putting risk to me or a future baby or a future child, yeah, is that wise? That's what you could come back and say. So I don't really know. I still feel like I would lean towards no, not getting it. But I say that with a smile because I know you're so opposite. But yeah, I have more understanding of like, yes, this is a real dynamic. That's not just like an imagination or like this like far out thought. Like it's a very real thing for our family specifically and probably for others that have health complications or autoimmune diseases or what have you. That I do think it plays, there is some nuance to it, but by and large, I would say that no, you should not do it. It's playing God.
Okay, one last small distinction. We've talked about this before, but I think it's an interesting point. The distinction that in language that you used between like a vasectomy and getting your tubes tied, you said is an act of playing God, and other things you said are sinful. And those two things are, you choose those words carefully. What do you see as the difference? Why are some of those options sinful, and why are others of them maybe not sinful, but playing God? My understanding, like, mm-hmm. You wouldn't say vasectomy is sinful, mm-mm. But you are playing God in some sense. Maybe can you tease that out, or what you mean, the difference there?
Yeah, I can try. So sinful to me is any time that you are potentially engaging in the willful act of killing a child, whether you know it's happening or not. Like, I don't believe you can plead innocence. You are taking a form of birth control that prevents a pregnancy. And one of those ways that it prevents a pregnancy is not allowing a baby to implant, or an implanted baby not getting enough nutrients to survive and just being flushed out. Either way, to me, that is sinful because you're killing a baby. What I would say, that life begins at conception. So because of that, I feel that's very strong, that you're not guarding and protecting life, so that is sinful. The act of playing God, I don't think I would say it's so much. It sounds, that's strong language, playing God, and then not putting the word sinful to it, because I feel like it's more gray. Like there is this gray zone of like what maybe for me feels like playing God to someone else feels like just, yeah, I have this tool available and I want to use it. To me, it feels like playing God because you're doing something that's so, I mean, now it's a 20-minute procedure, but it's invasive and it's permanent. And God has a design for us to stop having babies, and that's menopause. So you are speeding up this process in a medical way that is the act of God, against how he created our bodies. So whether or not that's sinful or not, I guess is for he who uses it to be the judge of with the Lord. But yeah, I do think that it is playing God. I don't think I can say that it's sinful, but I can with 100% certainty say every form of birth control I do believe is sinful.
Yikes. Well, before we get to the next hot take, we're going to read a ad from our first sponsor in order to pay for my vasectomy because I don't. Just kidding. Okay. Whoa. I don't know if I can top the spice laid down in that first one. But okay, here's my first one. 8 minutes on the clock. We went over the last one, but that's okay. 8 minutes on the clock. Hot take number one. I think all churches should get off social media in 100%. And I actually kind of fully believe this one. This isn't just I 80% believe it and the rest is for show. I actually kind of fully believe this, that I don't think churches should exist on social media and specifically on Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. I'll say something else because you can put like your full sermons there and that's kind of it. And here's my reasoning. We have all this data now, all this data. And if you want to go listen to someone who's really smart talk about all of this stuff, you go listen to NYU professor Jonathan Haidt, and he's got a book coming out in the, I think, March or something like that, talking about all of this. We have all this data about how terrible social media is for our brains, for our relationships, for essentially our entire well-being. Social media is essentially the place we go now to have our souls crushed. And I just don't buy, other than a couple of very specific use cases, very specific. But in general, especially in the West, I just don't buy the argument that, well, yeah, bad things happen there, but we also do a lot of good through social media. I just don't buy that to be true. I'm not saying that no good things happen on social media. I'm saying that if you were to stack up the bad versus the good in like pennies, the good would be like a roll of pennies and the bad would be like the Pacific Ocean filled with pennies. Mm-hmm. It's just so grossly out of balance now. And the way that churches essentially engage in social media, it's these little cute sayings and memes and announcements and, you know, these slick, you know, little like maybe sermon mashups that are 30 seconds with little clips and whatever. All of which, you know, spicy take 1B here, are kind of useless and pointless. Someone name me the last four, you know, inspiring things you read from a church on Instagram. Like, you just can't name them. They don't stick with us. And they don't stick with us because social media is designed to not stick with us. It's designed to come in and out, and so we have to go to something else to grab our attention. The design is actually to be engaging in short, rapid bursts so that it sticks with, so we stick on the platform and we keep, you know, death scrolling. And I just don't think that that's the place that the church should be. I think more and more in our digital age, I'm doubling down on the church being flesh and blood, being incarnational, being relational, being a place of real connection, where Facebook and Instagram and places like this have kind of tried to hijack this idea of connecting with each other. And we don't connect with each other at all, really, there. We fight with each other and we get in our echo chambers and all that kind of stuff and yell at each other. But I'm doubling down on the church actually being a flesh and blood body that talk and have meals and go on walks and take our kids to the park together and that kind of thing. I just don't think any good can happen. Yeah, really, I don't really think much of any good can happen on social media with the church there, other than, like I said, I know of ministries and people who are doing things in parts of the world that the church cannot exist, and the way they reach people is through different platforms. That's a different use case. That's a very specific thing to very specific people in very specific parts of the world. That's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about all the churches that we know and have and belong to and whatever back in the West. I just don't see any real need.
Yeah, that is a hot take, especially nowadays. So my question for you would be, what about the argument that I've heard from people of, yes, social media is so dark. Yes, there are so many negative things happening there. Isn't the church supposed to be light in the darkness? Isn't that what the church is? So if this is where so many people are engaged with, which the population, I don't know percentages, but it would probably be like just unbelievably overwhelming, how many are engaged on them. Actually, I probably could name like two people in my life that aren't. Like, it's something very small. So if that's where population exists and is regularly engaging with, the argument I've heard coming back is like, don't you want light there?
I have a few responses to that. One, the algorithms work in such a way that they only give us the things that we want to see. So people who are in darkness see the things that they are interested in. They are largely not seeing your church's posts. That's the way the algorithm works. Unless your church is spending lots of money on advertising on Facebook or advertising on Twitter or something like that. But if you just leave it up to the algorithm, they won't see it, because it's designed for them not to see it. It's designed for them to give them the things that they want to see. So functionally, that doesn't actually make sense. It's not how the internet works in 2023. Maybe it did in 2013. It's not how it works in 2023. Number two, again, I don't buy an Instagram post being a witness. What form of light is that? What virtue is that giving? What work of the Spirit, fruit of the Spirit, gift of the Spirit is that exuding to be light in darkness? Like, basically none. So I just don't think that that's how that works. I don't think that's how the internet works. I don't think that's how the witness works. And maybe you know some, I don't know. I don't know any person who has come to meaningful faith through social media. I know people who were invited by people and then came, and maybe that social media played some small role. I've never yet met that person that's like, you know what saved me? Facebook. Mm-hmm. You know what saved me? A tweet. Mm-hmm. Or whatever it's called now on X. Shout out to Elon. But anyways, I think we should just abandon that ship altogether. Let it sink. Be focused on relationships and incarnational, and have conversations with people. Learn how to actually have conversations with people again.
Yeah, I think another pushback would be like, what about communication? That's probably how people get their news. Hey, we're having service at this time. I'm sure that's a justification out there of like, hey, I have social media so that everybody can be informed in a really quick and easy way. What would you say to that?
It's amazing that churches functioned prior to 2012. What do you know? We figured it out for thousands of years, how to stay in touch with each other, how to have relationships with each other before 2012 when Instagram came along. So again, that's living as a prisoner of the moment and thinking that, you know, there's some unsolvable problem that, I don't know, we had solved for 2,000 years. So I don't buy it.
But what about like the argument of being relevant to the culture? So say you take yourself out of social media, you go old school, you have a phone tree maybe, and you have to call everybody or however you decide to do it. What about the argument of you are not even relevant and can't speak into today's culture because, like, you don't even engage in these platforms.
One, you can still use email and text and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not saying throw all technology out and go, you know, Stone Age or Amish or something like that. But two things. One, I don't think the church is supposed to be relevant to the culture. Where is that? We're actually supposed to be different than the culture. That's the whole point. We are not like you. Not we are a Christian version of you. I think the whole cultural relevance idea that really came about in the 70s and 80s and then really came into full bloom in the 90s in the West, I think is just a false notion. We are meant to engage the culture 100%, but I don't need, Twitter is not the place that we engage the culture. Twitter is the place that you get into Twitter wars, and Instagram is the place that you, you know, post about your great life and everybody else's food. Like, it's not engaging in the culture. Conversation is where you engage with the culture. Actually going outside and building relationships with people that are not like you, that do not believe, that are of a different race or socioeconomic status or political party, that's how you engage the culture. Joining your kid's school board or going to the library, like, those are ways that you engage the culture. Social media is not how you do that. And we're not, I don't think, meant to actually be relevant in the way that we mean that term. We're not meant to be relevant to the culture. Okay, we've gone way over. Okay. All right, give us your second hot take. And please, God, let it not be as spicy as the first one because I can't handle it.
I don't think it is, okay. Although we'll see when I say it. Okay. Hot take number two for me is that I think it is sinful for security guards on church campuses to be carrying a gun.
Okay, full disclosure, I had a list of like 7 or 8 things. This was on mine too. I was not going to give this one, but this was on my list. We're in agreement here. Tease out.
Well, just to go back, we are actually in agreement on the social media one as well. So far, okay. We only disagree on my first one. So I just think that there isn't any scriptural backing for it being okay to guard the church and guard the gathering of the saints with a gun, with which guns were recreated to kill. Like, they're, that was the purpose. That's the purpose to have them. And I feel like it's very clear that we are not to ever kill or murder. And we have a hope that's greater. God forbid someone did come in and cause harm in a service. Like, that's the witness of believers that, like, yeah, you can take my life because I have a hope beyond this life. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do anything ever. I'm just saying that the line of carrying a security guard carrying a gun should just, in my mind, not even be in our language. Like, that should be appalling and offensive if you are going to a church and you find out that there's a security guard that is armed. Like, I think that's, yeah, egregious.
Okay.
Those are strong words.
Those are strong words, and I 100% agree with all of them. I think it's, I do. I think it's kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. A ridiculous notion to say that we are going to protect ourselves with means of deadly violence, especially to protect ourselves as the gathering of believers. The idea of doing such a thing is so anathema in church history. It's so against everything that the early church, the first 3, 4, 5 centuries of the church believed in, and for most of the church in most of places after that. I mean, there's exceptions and all that kind of stuff, but those are the negative exceptions when the church used violence. That, yeah, I would love for someone to walk me through their scriptural argument for why that is. Okay, so let me ask you this. If your church if you found out that your church, they had security, which most churches now of decent size do, they have some kind of security or first response team or something like that, and you found that they were concealing and carrying, how would you handle that?
I don't know. I would really have to pray about it and about how to handle it, because I don't think it would be wise to go up to the security guard and talk to them about it, because it's probably not their decision. So it would be figuring out who is making that decision and hearing their, what you just said, what is their argument for it? What is their thoughts? It's probably and likely the head of who's running the church, having that conversation of at least hearing them out of like, okay, help me understand how we are following the same God and reading the same scripture and coming to obviously vastly different conclusions on how to go about this. To at least understand what the thought is behind it. And not just the thought. I want to know how you can look at the life of Jesus and come to that conclusion. I don't want to know your justification of, well, these are our people. I'm guarding and protecting them. I want to know how you can look at the life of Christ and who we're supposed to be modeling and come to that same conclusion. So I would start there with a conversation of asking a lot of questions to specifically see, like, am I missing something here? Is there something I can learn? Can we have a dialogue about this and about potentially changing it?
Yeah, I agree. I think having a conversation with, yeah, likely the senior pastor or one of the pastors is going to be your first kind of step. And then you'd have to see where it goes after that. I don't know how far I would take that as far as like leaving or something like that. I don't know if it's to me on those grounds, but it is like some real serious conversation, because it does, I think, send a message about the seriousness by which we want to obey even the deepest of God's commands and actually trust in the deepest of God's commands and the way of Jesus. There's a commitment. I think this is especially true of Americans, who obviously love their guns more than basically anybody else on the planet. There's a real idolatrous pull and culture in America around guns. And I think the church, every local church, needs to wrestle with that issue, both for the kind of the private lives of its congregants, and how do we talk about that, and for sure in the public life of the church as we gather together.
Yeah. I mean, I think the answer to that question is really defining what they believe, who God is, and what is he like. And I think that is the core issue of whether your decision of however you handle it is like, yeah, who is God to you? Like, how do you read scripture? Who is Jesus to you? And what is he like? And what does he command us to do? So I think there's that deeper question there. I do want to just say, on a practical level, like purely practical, I think it is just stupid. I am a medical person that has been in emergency situations and trained, like life and death situations, and trained in how to handle it and have the skills. And my heart still races and my hands still get a bit shaky or whatever it is. And that's in a trained environment that I've rehearsed and practiced. So to think that most of these security guards, and maybe not all, but are lay people just, you know, serving the church and given a gun, that in a true emergency situation where there is an active shooter, that this person is going to be accurate in how they use it and make wise decisions with it and not hurt any other, like, person running from the scene in the chaos of what that moment would be, is pure stupidity. Like, I am not beating around the bush. I think it is the dumbest thing to think that a lay person can, like, accurately shoot somebody across the sanctuary with all of these people screaming and running, falling. Who knows what the chaos of that situation would look like? So just as a moment of like, oh, is this a good idea? Whether or not it's like, okay, biblically as followers of Jesus, is it a good idea to give like Joe Schmo a gun that like maybe goes out on the range with his son and shoots or hunts? This gun that like in this heated moment when their blood is pumping, their heart is pounding, they can't even make sense of the room, and now you're giving them this thing to make life and death decisions. Like, I actually think that gun would do so much more harm than good. The chance of it hitting someone that it should never hit, if that situation occurred, is way better than it hitting who it's supposed to hit in that situation.
Okay. One last question on this. When we lived in Colorado, we went to a church, New Life, that actually had an active shooter situation in its history. They actually had an outsider who meant to do harm show up and open fire during the service. I don't know what their private security team does. We weren't there long enough and didn't get to know the pastors well enough to find that out. But one thing I do know is that after that thing, they now have hired the police department, members of the police department, the Colorado Springs PD, come to the church every Sunday and stand outside the doors. And so they actually have police stationed at the doors. And you remember when we went, the police would be there every week and greet you and whatever, but they were there not as congregants, they were there as the actual police. Do you feel any differently about that? Now you're not putting a gun in the hands of the congregants, you're putting it in the hands of the police, which there would be a way of reading like Romans 13 that would say, hey, we have police to, you know, keep wrongdoers from doing wrong, that kind of thing. Do you think an okay justification, or is it just like, hey, we should just abstain from all use of forced self-protection as we come together and we are just trusting God?
Yeah, that's a unique situation on how they handled it. And I do think it's different. I do think it's really different. I don't necessarily know if I would say, yeah, that should be the solution versus not having anything. But if you are going to go down the path of wanting that security, I think that's almost the only way to do it, is to have someone exactly like you're saying, like the police department. They are not attending as a congregant. You are setting them up in it's a completely different light. Now, whether or not that, I think that's a great discussion of if they should be there or if it should be nothing at all. But I do see having them there versus just like a security team from the congregation as literally completely separate things.
Okay. All right, last one. My second hot take here is I do not think God gets angry, nor is he violent. Full stop, period. God does not get angry, and he is not violent. Full stop.
Like ever?
Like at all. God does not get angry and is not violent. Period at the end of the sentence.
How do you come to that conclusion? Guys, this is my first time hearing you ever say that. So I'm just like, wait, what? Help me understand what you're saying. Like, you've obviously thought this through. So walk me through what you mean by how you came to that conclusion.
Okay. Yes, I got her. First thing. Curveball. So how I would explain it is this way. In theological terms, we have a term that God is immutable, that he does not change. And that is an especially important theological term for a few reasons. Number one, it means that we can trust him. That's usually how we think about it, that he doesn't change. So what he promised yesterday, we can trust for tomorrow. He was one way, you know, yesterday, he's going to be that way tomorrow, all of that kind of stuff. But one of the other ways one of the meanings, important meanings of that is the immutability of God, is that nothing from the outside of him can impinge upon his being, can affect who he is. He is who he is all of the time, and there is nothing and no one that can change that about him. And what we are claiming when we say that God gets angry in our human understanding is that someone from outside of God does something that actually affects God so that he changes in his emotional state. And it makes God essentially not a victim in the sense of we're doing something wrong, but it makes him a victim of someone else's act. That someone else is able to do something that changes who he is or his emotional state. And that is something that we cannot say because it makes that person stronger than God. Does that make sense?
I have so many thoughts right now. But God is a person. And Jesus definitely was full human. And so we see scripture of God in Jesus being angry. And I think if you take out that dynamic that you're explaining, my thought would be, isn't God robotic? Because we serve a relational God that needs to have a response to our, whether it's good or bad, like a response to our actions, response to our worship, response to our love, response mm-hmm. to our sin. Like that is the definition of a living relational God. If you take out that emotion of anger, I'm just curious how you don't just create a robot of like, no matter what you do, it's unaffecting me. And therefore I just stay this way. Like, how are you still in relation without that?
Oh, this is so good. Okay. One, yes, Jesus experienced human emotions because Jesus became human. And so part of God's becoming man and entering into the human experience is to experience human emotion. But God the Father and God the Spirit are not human in that way. The triune God as a whole is not human in that way. They do not experience human emotions in that way. Because if I can do something to you that makes you angry, I have power over you. If I can do something to you that makes you sad, I have power over you. I can manipulate you by my actions. I can manipulate or affect your state of being. Yes?
No, that's called relationship. That's not power. Mm-hmm. When it's twisted and used in the form of power and manipulation, mm-hmm. that is outside the mm-hmm. design of God. That is relationship, I would mm-hmm. say. And in relationship, it is necessary mm-hmm. that what I do affects you and what mm-hmm. you do affects me. Yes, absolutely. Because in our dynamic with God, like what he's done and does mm-hmm. affects me. And my worship and love and adoration for him affects and brings him joy and mm-hmm. loves it. And like there's so many verses about that. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, you can't. I feel like this makes God become a robotic. And then the other question or pushback I would have to this is like, first off, is there righteous anger? That would be a question. Mm-hmm. And then my second question of whose likeness were we created in? The mm-hmm. likeness and image of God. Mm-hmm. That's the full spectrum of emotions, unless mm-hmm. you're saying that the expression of anger is not found in God. And then in whose image were we created? Mm-hmm. Like, where did that come from then?
Okay, let me answer the relational question first. No, God feels towards us what God always feels towards us. He feels himself towards us in its fullness all of the time. He does not waver between... Now, let me finish the thought. He does not waver between happy and sad and angry and pleased and loving. He does not have like we have a set of emotions that are, the levels are rising and falling based on the surroundings around him. Whether you, whether it's manipulative or not, okay? And first of all, I would say the fact that humans are who they are, of course they would do that to God. That's what it would mean for us to be sinners. So, but he doesn't have those categories in the way that we have them, that are rising and falling. And one moment, anger is more prominent, and then we ask for forgiveness, and now love and mercy is more prominent, or something like that, like a human maybe would be. No, God feels and is who God is towards us all the time. Now, here's where the second part is important. How we experience God, that does change. How we experience him towards us, that 100% changes. And this is, I think we were talking about this the other day, but in a completely different context. It's like, to me, this is like the theological shift here in viewpoint is like that of Copernicus, who was the scientist who first figured out and observed that we were moving around the sun. The sun was not moving around us. For thousands of years, people looked at the sun and it rose in the west and set in the east. Rose in the east and set in the west. And we watched the sun move every day for millennia. And we stand here and everything looks still. And then Copernicus comes along and says, no. Your eyes are deceiving you. We are the ones moving. It looks like the sun is moving, but you are moving. Your relationship to the sun is actually the thing that is changing, not the sun itself that's changing. And I think it is something akin to that. It's a perspective shift that we need about God, because, and to me, you said it earlier, the good news of the gospel is precisely that God's feelings towards me never change. His feelings towards me are what they are all of the time, from death, or from birth to death, regardless of what I do, regardless of where I go, regardless of how I sin, regardless of how I repent. God is nothing but God to me all of the time, because he cannot be anything else. Now, how I experience that in my limited human frame, in my emotions, in my perception, in my knowledge, in my understanding, in my situation, in my culture, in my time, I experience those things in particular ways. And so what God being God to me when I'm full out doing crazy stuff, I will interpret as one thing. But that's me actually spinning, not the sun spinning. That's me revolving around the sun, not the sun revolving around me. The sun is the sun. It is burning hot gas flame in the sky. And I'm the one on a little rock spinning 1,000 miles an hour on its axis, tilted. I'm not standing stationary at all. I'm actually spinning super fast on a rock and then going around the sun. Like, that's me moving. And how I am experiencing that will change. And so then when I repent, or when I turn my heart towards God, the difference in feeling there is not that God changed from angry to loving. It's that I changed, or rather, he has changed me to now experience him in the way that is more true to who he is. But the way that he truly is the way that he always has truly been and always truly will be. Does that make sense?
I am following. I think I don't agree, but I'm following. And maybe I need to broaden my understanding of God's emotions, but I definitely think anger is one of them. And maybe he is the same, which that we know, the same yesterday, today, and forever. But maybe anger can simultaneously exist with love, just like it can simultaneously exist with all his other facets, in a way that still keeps God, God, but also keeps his anger, and anger can be righteous, and that righteous anger a part of his character. So I don't think that God is just never angry, full stop. Mm-hmm. I think we have enough scripture to see the side of God that was experienced as anger. And so, yeah, I guess maybe I needed to broaden my thought of, like, very humanistic in my mind of, like, at this moment of, like, experiencing one emotion at a time. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's not God's experience of emotion, but mm-hmm. I still think anger's there.
Yeah. So what I'm claiming here is that God does not feel emotion in the way that we feel emotion. That's what I'm claiming. No. Let me finish. She's waving her finger at me. Okay. And so that when we ascribe emotions to him, like anger, what we are ascribing to him is an anthropomorphism. It's a human category based in our own experience, in our own definition, that is being projected upon God so that we can make sense of him. But that projection of what we call anger is not actually what God is or what God is experiencing, if you want to call it that. I don't even know if saying that he's experiencing is the right term, because he just is who he is, right? So it is not that God is what you maybe call emotionless, that he's not this stone, he's not a robot, he's not nothing, like you said. What I am saying is that he does not get angry in the way that we mean when we say God gets angry. Everything that we mean when we say anger, or, I mean, honestly, you could say, you don't even have to use a negative emotion here. You could use, honestly, any emotion that you can think of. God does not have that emotion in the way that you mean that he has that emotion. He has something completely other than. And when we talk about God's emotions, all we're doing is taking our limited knowledge and experience and viewpoint and projecting it onto him in order to make sense of him. But what is important, and why I actually think this is an important claim, is to say, is we need a view of God that says he is beyond all of our categories. He is immutable. He does not change. He is simple, meaning he is who he is. He's not pieces put together in one thing. And that the seeming contradictions that happen in ourselves, things like justice and mercy that often get pitted against each other and feel like contradictions to us, they are not contradictions to God, because God just is who he is. He is not contradictory in himself whatsoever, because he doesn't have emotions like we have emotions that can seem to be pit against each other. And we've all had experiences in our life where we are feeling two emotions at the same time and they feel like they are in contradiction with one another. That feeling does not happen in God, because he doesn't have emotions like we have emotions. He doesn't feel or flare up or exude emotions like we do. He simply is who he is, and there is nothing that anyone can do to stop him from being him to them. And to me, that's a fundamental claim, because it's a fundamental truth of the gospel, that any person, no matter what they are doing, the reason we can believe that they are not outside the reach of God is simply because God is who he is to them all of the time, no matter what that they do. How they experience him is different. But that's them, that goes back to the Copernicus thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm following your argument for sure. But in the beginning you said God is not angry, full stop. Mm-hmm. And I would just push back to that and disagree with that for sure.
But again, what I mean by that is, when I say God doesn't get angry, and everybody has their idea of what anger is, how that, and again, you don't even have, this is again why it's a hot take, because anger will we'll put some spice on the take here. But you could put any emotion there. All of those are going to be minuscule, shallow, watery projections that we are putting on God to try and make sense of the God that is.
Yeah, but in what you're saying, I fully understand what you're articulating and what you're saying. I would just disagree that by God experiencing an emotion doesn't change his essence. I think that's what you're describing, when not his experience, but his essence of who he is, fully merciful, fully just, full of justice, full of all of these things. And you're saying that that's just who he is and therefore cannot experience emotion in like a changing facet of like sometimes it's this and sometimes it's that. I'm not sure I fully agree with that. I feel like God can still be God and unchanging, but also very relational. And in relation, those things do shift and come to the forefront. Like when Jesus was flipping tables, I don't know that I believe that he was fully in his humanity in that emotion. Mm-hmm. That was an expression of what God was feeling and grieved and hurt and that displayed, obviously, in that way. But yeah, so I completely understand what you're saying. Hot take number two of yours, we don't agree with.
Yeah, and I, again, anytime you want to point to Jesus, I'm going to say, yeah, that's God condescending into human form. That's what it looks like when the God that is takes on flesh and has human experience, human emotion comes out, because something has to come out because he's fully God and fully human. But when we talk about the triune God, and particularly here, I'm thinking of God the Father and God the Spirit, they are not human. They did not become man. And so they do not exude and experience emotion in the same way, so that I don't think you can say they get angry, because that word get, that verb get, implies a change in state. I was not, and now I am. And that action, internal action, I don't think God experiences. God simply is who he is to humans all of the time, and we experience him in the way that we are orbiting around him. That's how I would, but we're way, way over now. But that's good, because that means it was a good spicy take. And we didn't even talk about the second part of the take, that he doesn't use violence, but we'll save that for a different time. We didn't even get to that part.
Yeah, we'll save it.
That's good. Okay, all right. Those are theological hot takes. Thank you to the Pod Mother for coming on. Thank you guys for listening. And I do hope to do some more of these and have some friends on and things like that, and kind of sprinkle these kind of more fun ones in from time to time. And if you have a hot take, actually, this would be fun. Okay, if you have a hot take, in the description, the show notes of this episode, will be a link that you can write me a message or an email or something like that. I'll figure something out. And if you have a theological hot take that you would like to submit to talk about, put it in there. I'd love to hear it. And we can put some of those out maybe in a future episode as well. So, okay, with that, I'll go. Thank you so much, Steph. Love you. We have to talk about our family future and planning and things like that.
Yeah, we do.
But I appreciate it. And we'll see you guys all soon. Bye-bye.